From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Many white Americans have a history of slave ownership in their ancestry. It's an inescapable fact of this nation, no matter how hard history books and our political discourse attempts to erase it. For one woman who was born in the South, erasing her family's history was not an option. Frances Causey, a longtime filmmaker whose credits include Heist, Who Stole the American Dream, has explored her family history and through it the history of mass enslavement in the United States in her new film. It's called The Long Shadow, and here is the film's trailer.
I was born in Greensboro, North Carolina, into a world where white superiority was rarely questioned.
And I remember going to the soda fountain, and Anise would be standing behind me. I'd go, "Why aren't you sitting with me?" And she said, "It's okay, honey. I'll just stay back here."
I knew both sides of my family owned slaves. I never understood how much my own uncomfortable journey to talk about this was connected to an untold history of our nation.
You can't understand United States history without understanding the role that slavery played. It actually defined the nation.
Almost every founding father was a slave owner. So it was just completely integrated into the thinking of the wealthy men that wrote the Constitution.
As I understand the history, they said, wait a minute, we can't have these principles of liberty applying to slaves.
The southern colonies were not willing to be part of a union unless the institution of slavery was protected, and the price of protecting that institution was disproportionate power to the south, and it carries through today.
They're mad. I'm mad. We should all be mad because of what's going on right now.
We're still suffering the after effects of those two powerful regimes that comprise the bulk of U.S. history, slavery and Jim Crow.
It's kind of like an infection, I think. You know, it may go away, but it always bubbles back up to the top.
You see a presidency almost brought to ruin. The majority leader of the Senate, we won't do anything to make it possible for this person to succeed.
Is there anyone who can explain to me about the chains on fallen men?
This culture has been created that is still punishing and penalizing Africans with no attempt to connect the dots between slavery, Jim Crow, and the present. It's criminal because, you know, people are suffering and people are dying.
We had it exactly backwards, right, in terms of the Negro problem. We have a white problem in the United States, and it's reflected in our politics, the way we do our economy, and the way we think about ourselves.
We, as white people, have benefited enormously from our privilege. Why are we so afraid to face the possibility that we might actually gain something with true equality?
And that's the trailer of the new film, The Long Shadow, by my guest, Frances Causey, who now joins me. Welcome to the program, Frances.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. So you've made a lot of films before about political issues. I mentioned Heist, and you have other films in your credits. Now you took on, in this new film, a story that is both deeply political, given what's happening in our country today, and for you, deeply personal. What led you to this moment? Was it the election of Trump?
Certainly in part, although I didn't want to overtly politicize the film because I try to reach as big an audience as I can. But I think probably a seminal moment for me happened when I studied what was going on in Ferguson, Missouri. And I knew something was deeply wrong in this country when it came to race relations, having grown up in the South. And so that really catalyzed me. Ferguson really catalyzed me. And as I began to study more of the political strategies around race, it really catalyzed me to make the film.
So let's talk a little bit about your family history. So you're from Virginia?
Actually, I'm originally from North Carolina, but I have a lot of Virginia ancestors.
And you found out through exploring your family history that you were related to a man named Edmund Pendleton. Who was he and why is he a seminal figure in the story you tell?
Sure. So when I did began the research, which, you know, included reading several books, and I ran across a biography of Edmund Pendleton, who was my sixth uncle. And he was a statesman and he was a lawyer. He was and also a slave owner in Virginia. And so I really, you know, when I got inspired by what had happened to tell what was going on with this country in terms of there being two Americas, one for white people and one for black people, I found more about Edmund Pendleton than I really bargained for. And mainly what I discovered was when he went to the Continental Congress in 1774, and as I said, he was a statesman for Virginia, and he essentially helped break this impasse that the founding fathers had come to when it came to slavery and also the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence more specifically. And so he came up with language that basically signaled to slave owners, you know, as this new country was being formed, that they were going to deal with slavery by not dealing with it. In other words, all of those rights, liberty and justice for all, they all agreed tacitly. They didn't mention it, but they all agreed that the slaves would not be included. But they needed language to signal that to other slave owners. For instance, in the northern states, this was in the Virginia Declaration of Rights that he is writing with George Mason at the time. And so he essentially, with a particular phrase, when they enter into a state of civil society, talking about men. And of course, Africans, enslaved Africans in, you know, in 1775, 76, would never enter into a state of civil society. And so essentially what he did is he codified white supremacy into the earliest laws of the country. He had been asked by Thomas Jefferson to take British law, which was, of course, a part of the colonies, and transformed that into American law. And he did that initially with the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which became later a huge part of the Declaration of Independence, sadly.
Wow. So in exploring this history in your film, you bring in a lot of social scientists and political analysts, historians who tell this story, many of them African-Americans. And when you weave the story together, what is it that you learned that you didn't already know? Because, you know, people who pay attention in the United States and who read and try to keep their eyes open, which I'm assuming you are as your filmmaker, you feel like you know perhaps more than the average American about the history of slavery in this country. But did you learn new things through this film?
Well, it's a great question. And I set out to learn new things about the subject. As I said, I had always been, as a journalist, I'd always been very aware of this experience that African Americans had in my life while growing up in the South, and the, you know, this terrible grinding poverty that I witnessed there, and the oppression and the discrimination. And so I really went to school on the subject. I thought I knew a lot about it, but I also knew that I wasn't being told, or I felt, you know, in my soul that I wasn't really being told the truth. And certainly there was no complete history of, you know, in film form. There had been a couple of films made, but I really made the film that I wanted to see that I couldn't find, Sonali, which, and so it was just this great journey that Sally and I went on and the entire Long Shadow team in discovering stories like that of Robert Carter III, who was the wealthiest slave owner in Virginia in the late 1700s. He actually emancipated his slaves because he had a religious awakening and he knew that slavery was wrong. That story had really been lost to history.
And yet religion was used as a tool to, unfortunately, justify slavery too, and the industry of slavery.
Oh, without question. In fact, I really wanted to include more of that in the film, but it is its own topic, the way
people have written books about it that we've covered show.
Right. I think Martin Luther King said it's the, you know, Sunday morning is the most segregated time in America. And that's not changed. And unfortunately, it's deepened. And once the religions began to see that the profits that slavery produced in the country, they even polarized the country more through the pulpit. And one time, slaves and their masters worshiped alongside each other. And then, of course, we start to see by the turn of the 19th century, we see just a huge, huge profit from slave ownership. And so, stories like Robert Carter III, the story about the British Columbia, Black pioneers who fled oppression in California when it was clear, or it was looking like California might become a slave state. But the overriding, you know, issue or idea in the film is the incredible political power of the South organized around white supremacy and how that has impacted us institutionally, and particularly African-Americans, in terms of economics, culture, politics. And then we connect the dots today. And so I did not understand the full effect of the South's political power until I made this film. Mm.
Frances, so you open your film with testimony from people who remember being enslaved. That is so chilling, because many Americans, even the ones who accept that it was a stain on our history, like to think of it as something in the deep past. But of course, it's not. There are still people who have grandparents who had that transition from being enslaved to being freed. And so today, we also have these justifications for why there's a income difference and wealth disparity between Blacks and whites that most Americans don't want to link back to the fact that slavery was actually a pretty recent institution. Is that also an issue you want to take on?
Oh, without question. I mean, it's one of the underlying important messages and aspirations of the film is to really connect the dots of our history. And history is a living organism. You know, we know more and more and more about the impact of slavery and what actually happened, and also connecting the dots to the present, mass incarceration, police brutality. These are all, in my opinion, artifacts of slavery. And so what I wanted to do was, I made the film for everyone, and the African-American community has really embraced the film. It's been so heartwarming. But in all honesty, I made the film for other white people who perhaps might not consider themselves racist, or they don't know how to bring up the issue of racism in our society. And it's very hard to understand and come to grips and deal with an issue in society if you really don't have the correct facts. Mm. And so one of the things that we show in the film is that as African-Americans began to make advancements in our society, we would hit them again with more oppression. And it was very difficult for me to believe growing up in the South that we did not outlaw legal discrimination against African-Americans until 1965 with the Civil Rights Act. Right. And so, but after that, we continue to see institutional oppression and things that have created, at this point, inequality is, and not to discount the huge strides made by African-Americans, but I really wanted white people to understand from another white person that, you know, what had happened, and that we need to claim responsibility for it. Mm. And we need to discuss the implications of Jim Crow, the Black codes, slavery. All of this is very, very much evidence in our society, the problems.
So the institution of slavery generated huge amounts of wealth, right, in white America. And when that institution was, through violence and force and great reluctance, ended, the economic disparity that was baked into the country remained. There were no reparations. So the wealth generated by slavery remained in the hands of white families. The wealth stolen from African-American communities remained stolen. This remained a community that had basically to start with negative worth, if you will. And that has never been addressed. We've never had a truth and reconciliation issue or you know, a sort of process in this country, which is another reason I'm assuming that your film was such a critical thing for you to make. You mentioned a couple of things just now, the black codes, which, you know, not enough, say, American kids learning history know about. What were the black codes?
Well, so what happens, right, we passed the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which free slaves and give them citizenship. But we instituted a series of laws, local laws throughout the South, much like what was happening in Ferguson that disproportionately impacted African Americans. And so the Black Codes were these series of laws, many, many, many local, right? Because it had been outlawed at a federal level. And so you could be rounded up if you were, now they're targeting African Americans, particularly in the South, right? And so they're targeting them for things like loitering. And then they're imprisoned. And by the same token, you have sheriff's departments that are contracted with coal mines and corporations down in the South to basically do something called convict leasing. So the Black Codes were these laws that rounded up African Americans for doing hardly anything, maybe spitting on the sidewalk, but it disproportionately impacted African Americans, like it did in the Ferguson court system. When you look at the Ferguson court system and how Black people were issued citations, rounded up for things at a much, much higher rate than white folks were, that's what the Black Codes were. I mean, it's basically a reinvention of slavery through things like convict leasing. And so as Dr. Allen points out in the film, you could basically work when they were slaves, right? They had a fairly high monetary value, which is even still hard to say, but when they were rounded up, thrown in jail, and became convicts, you could work them to death and then just move on to the next, you know, batch of incarcerated people. And then, of course, I mean, you see some of the worst racism. More lynchings took place from 1910 in this country until 1940 than at any other time in our history. That's when you start to see the building of monuments that are really dedicated to white supremacy and dedicated to putting African Americans in their place.
Right,
and
those Confederate statues that have become the focus of so much controversy were almost a last gasp of the Confederacy to remain relevant after it was dismantled, right?
Right. Yeah, and just one more thing about your question that I just found dumb, just blew me away. A lot of people don't realize that the South was so politically powerful that when FDR went to pass his New Deal, there was a lynching bill that they were trying to pass. And essentially, the South went to FDR and said, if you pass this lynching bill, we're not going to sign your New Deal. And when they did sign, I mean, this is to outlaw murder. The lynching of African Americans in the country to make it a federal crime. And then the other thing your listeners and viewers might not understand, it's like when it came to Social Security benefits, Social Security benefits did not apply to the two main Black vocations of the day, Sonali, which were agricultural work, sharecropping, and domestic service. So families like mine, and many, many of your listeners who began to get Social Security, which is a backbone of the American dream, this was pretty much off limits to African Americans, even though they were fighting in World War II. And then, of course, in the film, we get into federally sanctioned housing discrimination. And my family had generations to build housing wealth. All of this was cut off to African Americans. And even to this day, African American from one generation to the next are starting from scratch. And these are things that I don't think, honestly, white people really think about and really understand and feel. Because, I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't white folks who suffer, but when you look at the collective oppression and institutional racism, it's a very strong and sad story.
And today we have these attempts to rewrite history. And frankly, we just have a lot of propaganda floating out around about symbols of the Confederacy, which, you know, that the Confederate flag is basically symbolic of all of the evil that you've just been discussing. And we have Americans reviving that symbol and thrusting it into the faces of people of color, of African Americans and white progressives and Americans in general, as if it is just something to be proud of, you know, in terms of having pride in one's history and being patriotic. And so that whitewashes, no pun intended, this ugly history. How critical is it to expose that? Because there's this very, you know, there's a facade that enables some people in this country to feel self-righteous, to deny the fact that there's inequality baked into the system, and to, you know, push for continuing racist policies.
Right. No, it's hard.
Trump supporters. Not, let me just say it. Trump supporters.
Yeah, like you know, this focus around heritage, and really, it's a dog whistle. Ian Haney Lopez is in the film. He wrote a great book called "Dog Whistle Politics," and you know, it used to be that all of this base motivation and trying to get people politically motivated was a dog whistle. It was being spoken and said, but it was encoded language. And I think, I mean, what we saw with Charlottesville, I mean, sometimes it goes in and out of being coded and then very overt, but there's just no question what the Confederate flag stands for. The heritage is state-sanctioned inequality, state-sanctioned racism, white superiority of white over black. And I think people just aren't coming to grips with, or maybe they know and they're just not being honest about what that really stands for.
So, Francis, the film, as you said, you really hope white Americans will watch it. How critical is it for people to try to explore their family history? Because part of the acceptance of whiteness in this country means a letting go of one's own heritage and one's history. It's the price of white supremacy is a steep one. And unfortunately, especially poorer white Americans cling to whiteness as sometimes their last vestige of privilege, but can't exploring one's family history, coming to terms with the history of slavery and slave ownership on one's own family, can't that also actually be a cathartic experience for people?
Well, it certainly was for me, and it was a way for me to explore my own biases and come to grips with them, and of course the cathartic release of that was this film. And I it's probably one of the more common comments I get from people. They come up to me and say, my family owned slaves, or they have, you know, their own stories of discrimination or oppression that their family did to people of color in their lives and stuff. So I think it's a big reason there's such a a boon in studying genealogy and things like that. But I think you have to study it with the right intent to understand more of who you are and how you came to embrace the ideas you did and maybe question those. I mean, it's not, I also hear a lot about people saying, you know, I really want to understand this history, but I don't know how to start the conversation. If it helps move the conversation forward by studying your own family and understanding your privilege, right, and how how white, I mean, one of the things I think the more interesting things in the film we point out is at the beginning of this country in the early 1600s, there was more integration between black and white really than there is now, which John Powell says at the Haas Institute in Berkeley says, you know, there was more integration, which is really, think about that. Mm-hmm. That is pretty incredible. And so this notion of whiteness, the fact that it's really a social construct that the founding fathers created to keep black and white separate, because they needed the indentured servants and Africans to build this country, which is what they did. And it's now time for us to recognize that, acknowledge it, and have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission and see if we can set about changing things, helping to refurbish the African-American community. I mean, there are many, many things that can be done.
Sure. I mean, there's people that have been pushing for reparations for years. Others have said that that's just too much. But at least to have the conversation so that we don't start from a place of defensiveness, because unfortunately, far too many people get defensive as if to acknowledge that their family history has racism and slavery in it must mean that they're automatically being accused of being a racist themselves.
No, I mean, look at, I mean, what I try to do is when people are critical of my film and, you know, let's talk logically. When the Japanese were interned during World War II, each family got $30,000. I mean, this is not something difficult to solve. I mean, we have done it before. And I think—
And not that money can erase the worst crimes, but it would be a nice start.
Absolutely. It's something.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Frances, for joining us. Where can people find out more about your film? Is there a website you can share?
Absolutely. Please go to thelongshadowfilm.com, thelongshadowfilm.com. And I'm happy to say that the film is going to be in Oakland near you on October 30th at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland. And if you scroll down on our website, you can get additional screening dates in your area, because I know this is a broadcast that goes nationally. So check out thelongshadowfilm.com and follow us on Facebook at The Long Shadow and Long Shadow Doc on Twitter.
Well, good luck to you. Thank you so much for joining us, Frances.
Thank you.
Frances Causey is a filmmaker. Her new documentary, which we've just been discussing, is called The Long Shadow. Her earlier film credits include Heist, Who Stole the American Dream? I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.